nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
I welcome you to WE606 at Purdue, the first lecture. My name is Gerhard Klimek, and I'd like to go over the general course information. The books we suggest for this course are Advanced Semiconductor Fundamentals for the first 5 weeks, and then Semiconductor Device Fundamentals for the subsequent weeks. We will have 9 homeworks. We will grade them, and the solutions will be provided, and we'll hand out the homework assignments every Tuesday at the beginning of the lecture. There will be three exams about 5 weeks apart, and the web page for this class for Purdue is here on WE606, and there's information on Blackboard. I will try to have the lectures up there on Blackboard so you can print them out, so you don't have to take manic notes all the time. You can add on top of the notes, and I will have office hours right after class here in my EE office, and I will have office hours after my second class on Thursdays at 4:30. All right. So for this course, we have a whole bunch of resources available. I mentioned that we have this course already videotaped, and we're doing an update of this lecture now. It's hosted on NanoHub. That gives you a perspective of NanoHub users. These are global users we have on this website that we host here at Purdue, over 230,000 users in the last 12 months. And basically, where there's lights on at night, we have people on users across the world in 172 countries. There's a whole bunch of professional staff that operate this, and 5 other universities are involved, and we have over 3,000 resources there. So I think it's a very good resource to learn about semiconductors and nanoelectronics and the like. And so here's the outline of the presentation. So we'll go over general course information, and I'll try to motivate why this course might be really relevant to you. And we'll discuss the current flow in semiconductors, the material systems, and the classification of crystals. And you can find this as a reference in Volume 6, Chapter 1. And I will be viewing or referring to a tool called Crystal Viewer that's in the Abacus tool suite, and you can find that on NanoHub. All you have to do is go NanoHub, type Abacus, and in Abacus you will find Crystal Viewer. So I'm going to show you a chart that you might have heard the word of before, Moore's Law. But you might not have seen Moore's Law in this form, but this is its of Gordon Moore in 1965. He sketched this in his notebook, in his Intel notebook. He was a co-founder. And really what he sketched here, I transcribed the handwriting, number of components per integrated circuit versus the relative manufacturing cost per component. And this is on a log-log scale, and it goes down linearly. So there's obviously an exponential law there. What did he mean by that? As we go forward from 62, 65, and 70, he observed that one could put more and more components on an integrated circuit and lower the relative manufacturing cost. Okay? So this was an economic law, right? It's about the economy of making semiconductor devices and integrating them into a chip and then selling that thing. You might know of Moore's Law in more this fashion, where you might have seen charts like this, where over the years, the number of transistors per chip have grown from a couple of thousand in the 70s to over 2 billion in today's devices. Now, to put that in perspective, 2 billion individual switches and elements, circuit elements working sort of in a cohesive way with each other, right? That's like a third of the world population of working together in a cohesive form and not having war. Okay? I mean, it's quite an engineering marvel to integrate such a thing like that. Okay? So it's quite an engineering marvel, I would say. And so you might have seen it in this form. You might have also seen this chart. I like to show it. It's actually quite old, relatively speaking. It's from 2004. And part of Moore's law is not only putting more things together onto the same chip, as I showed on the previous slide, it's about making them smaller and more energy efficient as well. So Intel has marched forward over the years and classified their technology according to the ITRS roadmap. They're called nodes, and those are critical dimensions in a device, like a 65 nanometer node, 45 nanometer node, and so on. And that just means sort of a goal, a target that is being set. So this chart is from 2004, and he was looking forward to a 65 nanometer node in 2005, a 45 in 07, and a 32 nanometer node in 09. So the beautiful thing about this chart is now it's dated, but now you can look back on how well they did. This is Intel, right? So in 2009, they did announce a 32 nanometer node, right? So they've planned basically 5 years ahead and knew what was going to be in their chips down the line. So it took actually 2012 or maybe the very tail end of 11 to announce a 22 nanometer node, okay? But imagine that, where you really develop a technology as a technology person that is going to be 5, 6, 10 years down the line and is going to have to compete not against today's devices. It has to compete against the future devices that are already on the books. Okay, you can't just say, I have a better idea for a switch. It beats today's switch by X. You have to have an idea about beating the switch in 10 years ago, in 10 years in the future. Okay, so that's quite a different perspective. And so at that time, also this element here, it wasn't quite clear where we're going with this, right? We have nanofiber wires, carbon nanotubes, and my understanding from research and interacting with Intel and these companies, that they feel they have a 12 nanometer node already understood, and it's going to go in production as planned. Okay? So they tell me as a researcher, don't even worry about designing or helping us with a 15 nanometer node. We're done, right? We already know how we're going to produce that thing. So we have to compete in my research group about understanding a sub 10 nanometer device, like a 10 nanometer, 8 nanometer device. And we're writing software to understand that. So, how do we think about these devices, right? Conceptually, as a design element or as a theory element. I mean, this is sort of a pictorial diagram of Moore's law in a sense where in the olden days, devices are what we would call diffusive. They're so large that electrons sort of move through as almost like a gas, right? As a diffusive set of particles, but you don't even think of them as a particles. Then you move towards ballistic devices where you maybe think of these electrons as billiard balls sort of shooting through the thing. And then when you make things small, you have to be quantum, right? You have to explore the wave nature of all of this. And down the line, we have atomic dimensions. Just to put this in perspective, if you have a 10 nanometer device, well, that's 40 atoms wide, okay? So there's not a 10.1 nanometer device. There's a 40 atom and the 41 atom device, right? So these things are now becoming discrete. It's no longer a million atoms and a million and one, and so it doesn't matter, right? So we're getting close to atomic dimensions, and typically when you go to a physics course and you might hear quantum mechanics or statistical mechanics, you learn about constructing a Hamiltonian that describes a quantum mechanical system. You might solve Schrödinger's equation, and then you might deal with it in equilibrium and do statistical mechanics on this. Maybe you get sophisticated and learn about Green functions and perturb the system and do modifications to this. But this is where typically physics stops, right? Physicists have explored that regime of atomic dimension and quantum mechanics quite extensively. But in engineering, we have an additional issue. We actually have voltages that we apply, right? We would like to shuttle electrons through the device. So we take them out from one end, put them in the device, and take them out at the other end. This device is not in equilibrium. It's very far from equilibrium. So what you have to solve is not just a statistical mechanics or quantum statistical mechanics problem. You need to solve the non-equilibrium quantum statistical mechanics problem. So that's about as sophisticated and hard of a calculation you can imagine these days. And we can, in my research group, we can keep any of the supercomputers we have available busy on solving a problem like that, up to 200,000 cores, right? Not just two cores, 200,000 cores, right? It's a very computationally intensive problem. So about 20 years ago, it wasn't clear what is the formalism you might want to use. So when I was in grad school here at Purdue, we started to work on something called the non-equilibrium green functions approach. And out of that approach, you can rederive Boltzmann, you can rederive drift diffusion. Can you please turn on the light again? Thank you. And really, you have a unified model that derives from the bottom up, from atomic dimensions back up to large classical devices. And the beautiful thing about it is really that that formalism can treat any of the semiconducting or metallic or molecular devices or carbon nanotube devices that we're discussing in research today. Okay? So really, you can, even though these devices here look quite different and physically are made quite differently, the theory on this is quite the same, which is a cool thing. So, sorry. The issue is, for you, all of these concepts might be very strange and you might not have examined them, especially if you're an electrical engineer coming in more from a circuits perspective. So, we will touch on issues of atomic dimensions and how electrons are to be thought of, but then we'll quickly move into the more classical view of devices up here. So if you want to learn about all of this flow here, in a sense, or how to study transport at the nanometer scale, those are sets of courses all by themselves, and I highlight them again, right? So what we do in this course is really trying to understand the basic concepts that everybody in the industry still uses today and raise you to that level. In that process, we will have to look at some of the atomic dimension issues, okay? But we will not do quantum transport, really, in this course. There's also an issue that you probably are aware of in these devices, that's heat and power consumption. If you have bought a computer lately, it runs 2.5 gigahertz, thereabouts. You could buy a computer that ran 2.5 gigahertz about 8 years ago, right? They haven't gotten faster. And they haven't gotten faster because of this. They kind of have to stop here at about 100 watt per square centimeter. And that's about the power density of a nuclear reactor, right? On a chip that's maybe the size of your fingernail, and it consumes about 100 watt. That is the power density that you have on a nuclear reactor. If you make it any hotter, it gets really hot, and I don't know that you want to explode your device or put it on the sun, right? So somewhere there is an absolute limit on how much power you can consume on a chip. So that's the foundational reason really why these chips haven't gotten faster. They've gotten more complex and smarter in power consumption. They've gotten more parallel. My computer here has two cores, so you can buy a four-core machine, right? They got more complex in that sense, but they didn't get faster in clock speed. So, is that something new, right? Where we've seen the temperature on these chips rise significantly, right, over the years. And that happens really in MOS-type devices, metal-on-semiconductor devices. You might have heard of bipolar transistors. The first ones might have looked like this, right? And even there, it happened, they got integrated more and more, and the power consumption on these systems and energy consumption rose dramatically until an invention happened that really MOS devices became a viable solution to be mass manufactured. And before that, you might have even heard of tubes, right? Maybe your grandfather has talked about tubes or so, right? So, same thing happened. Then the bipolar transistor came, then the MOS transistor came. Now the question is, what happens now? Right? So there's a whole research world out there that is trying to generate ideas and concepts for the next switch. It's called the Nano Electronic Research Initiative. It's led by industry and by government. And I think that's something that could be quite exciting for you as well, because we are at a stage now where we are either inventing the next switch to be implemented in the next 5 to 10 years, or we're going to see this industry stagnate, right? Because it can't really make things smaller and faster anymore. So that's what the background excitement is, why you might want to consider looking into these semiconductors carefully and really understanding how electrons flow at the nanometer scale. Of course, you're all exposed to semiconductor devices in a sense, but you don't experience them as individual devices, right? You have computers like this, right? And on the bottom, you might think of as the CPU, right? And you know there's transistors on the CPU. Of course, you know about lasers for disk drives and lasers for pointers. But here, this display by itself, in a sense, is a computer, right? It's a bunch of transistors that are interacting with each other to make images, right? If you have your display that has a 1024 by 768 pixels, under each of these pixels, there is now a transistor, a set of transistors that lights up the pixel, right? So that by itself is a computer system. And the format is obviously very different, right? This thing is pretty big versus the microchip that's very small, right? So the requirements are going to be different. So we'll study what kind of devices might go into these systems, and we'll look at resistors and diodes and bipolar transistors and then MOSFETs. And these are roughly the breakout of the weeks. And under the hood, you have to understand a bunch of other things like quantum mechanics on how do electrons flow through a structure, how does band structure come about, then where the electrons are sitting in terms of energy, and then how they're being transported. Okay, so understanding the devices basically is sort of based on three concepts. Number one, where could the electrons be? Then the second one is, or think of them as apartments. How many apartments are in this building, and how many electrons could this house? Two, how many of these apartments are occupied, meaning the electrons are actually in the system and you can count them, so to speak. And three, how do you transport one occupant from one apartment to the next apartment? Okay, those are three distinct different concepts that we'll explore, and we'll march through them one by one over the next few weeks of the early part of the course. And then connect that overall to transport, and then map that into real devices. So that's what this course 606 is about. It's really about the principles of the device operation. So there's another course like 606. It's called 604 at Purdue. It's electromagnetics and magnetics. So how do signals propagate in electrical systems? So you'll learn how to do Maxwell's equations, etc., in realistic systems. And it's related in the sense that it's a foundational aspect to carrier flow as well. Now, once you have the principal operations understood, you might want to consider taking 656, which does semi-classical transport, or 659, which does quantum transport, or some biophysics, where you learn about more specific devices, how they're being used, how they're being optimized. And maybe you learn about new methodologies like finite element, molecular dynamics, Monte Carlo, characterization, quantum transport here with NEGF. Personally, I would advise any any theorist also to take 557 to at least learn once how these things are fabricated in a laboratory. And of course, if you're an experimentalist, this is sort of a must-take course to learn how to work in a fab and not to get hurt and not to hurt other people. Those are the first two items, right? And then how to make something useful. That's another important thing, right? Once you sort of mastered some of these items, you might want to look at more system or device specific things like RF design or optoelectronic systems or biosystems or here advanced semiconductor devices or 612 VLSI or nano devices and then biosystems as well. So this is really gives you a perspective of how this course sort of fits into an overall framework of courses. Okay, so but 606 is sort of at the core for these courses. So now you might say, so courses. Why would I really do this, right? So why do I have to take a foundational course? It's really to define the language, right, of how we communicate. When I say Fermi level, you know what I mean, right? And to really define a common language and concepts that are pretty specific to the micro-nano area. And it sort of bridges also the different communities and to electrical engineering in physics and other areas. So the other thing is you might want to consider learning this material very carefully if you want to continue for a PhD at Purdue, because this is the foundational questions you're going to have on your qualifying exam. And they're very foundational questions. They're not asking for specific designs or specific things on the QE. It's really, do you understand the basics? Do you understand our language and our concepts? That's what's being tested in the QE. So you, just for that alone, you might find this interesting, right? It's really about how to think about semiconductors and electrons and semiconductors and what these are. And actually, if you go out after your master's or your PhD and you want to work in a semiconductor company, it's very unlikely that they will probe you on the very specific details of what you did your PhD on. Because most of them don't understand what you worked on. You will be interviewing with 15 people in a two-day interview at a typical semiconductor company. And there will be one out of those interviews that really understands all the umph degree of detail that your PhD is about. All the others are working on more nuts and bolts type things, and they might also have a PhD, but they're going to probe you on these foundational things. So they will not go into detail, but they probe the understanding of foundational elements of transport in semiconductors. So while you think, oh, my PhD is great and I write 4, 5, 6, 10 different papers, chances are in your interview, they will ask you about things that by that time you consider, sort of, wow, I haven't thought about this for the last 4 years or 5 years. Okay. But the foundation is what is linking all these people together. Okay. All right. So I mentioned the outline. I'm going back to it now. So I hope to have given you a little bit of a motivation for this course, and now we're going to start looking at the concepts of current flow. So what we want to do is have a device and have some contacts, apply a voltage, and we kind of have a feeling for that this might depend on the chemical composition, the crystal structure, the temperature, doping. You might say doping. I don't even know what that is. It could be maybe tabulated for known materials, but what you really need is a theory of engineering these new devices and these new materials. So you have to think about electrons flowing along one direction, say, throughout the device, like the source and the drain. Since the electrons are negatively charged, the current flows the other way. Right, so it's a little quirk. And if we look at current flow like this, I'm sure you've seen in some electrical engineering classes, current is conductance times voltage, right? Just Ohm's law. And you have to ask yourself, so what is this made up of, right? And in terms of a device, you might want to think about a charge being transported, right, of an electron, and there might be n of them, and they move at a certain velocity across, okay? And you have a certain cross-section of them. So there's n particles at a certain velocity crossing at a certain cross-section, right? That would give you current. Has nothing to do with voltages yet on conductance, right? Right? So how do you relate these, right? What's the physical model that comes from particles at a certain velocity and to some applied voltages, and then the subsequent conductivity, right? I mean, and that is what this course is about, trying to teach you about how to think about the relation between these two. Okay? So, in a sense, the carrier density, the number of electrons, they really come from quantum mechanics and statistical mechanics, right? And they're encapsulated in the classical world in the concept of effective masses and occupation factors, okay? So that's number of apartments and occupancy of the apartments. And the velocity is really a matter of transport, and that might involve scattering, and it's really out of equilibrium, okay? And it's we work in this course here with the drift diffusion equation and recombination and generation of these particles. So these are chapters 5 and 6 in the textbook, and these are chapters 1 through 4. Okay, that sort of sets the stage of this. All right, so if you want to calculate the carrier density and the velocity, you have to understand atomic composition, meaning it gets you to the number of the electrons per atom. Okay? And maybe you need to know about how these atoms are arranged spatially, because not all of those electrons will be used for conduction. Okay? If they were all be used, they would leave all these cores behind, right? So there's somehow a selection which electrons conduct and which don't. And maybe you need to think about them as a periodic array of a crystal, because that makes life a whole lot easier when you want to compute some properties. So we'll introduce the concept of a unit cell and a 3D unit cell. So let's look at some of the semiconductors or materials, sort of elements that are out there. So this is chopped out of the traditional periodic table. So we have elemental semiconductors here, silicon, germanium, and carbon can be a semiconductor as well. And silicon by itself is a $260 billion industry. Okay, so traditionally, in the last 30 years, we made silicon-based chips. And globally, that's about $260, $280 billion. It's my understanding the semiconductor industry is the U.S. largest export industry today. We don't hear about that much. Then there's compound semiconductors that are not in column 4, but maybe in compounds made out of column 4 materials. So that's a step before going to other columns. So there's semiconductors made of silicon germanium and silicon carbon, for example. And their properties are slightly different than the pure materials like silicon and germanium. So, for example, silicon germanium can be quite a good conductor as well, and it's being used in today's devices since the 45 nanometer node. So since about 5 years, the silicon germanium is being used to squeeze the silicon material in transistors. And that changes the transport properties of silicon. And I see some of you in the audience raise your eyebrows and you ask yourself, how does that happen? And why would that happen? So we'll learn aspects of why that might happen. Silicon carbon has a very large band gap. And you might say, band gap? I don't even know what that is yet. But that's good for radiation tolerant devices or devices that are getting very hot, like next to an engine, right? It's temperatures of 400 Celsius or more, and maybe you still want to control this engine with semiconductor devices, and I can tell you that a silicon device can't work at that temperature. And you might say, why? It's a material, it's not melting. But I can tell you, and you will learn by the end of the course, you can draw a simple diagram and understand that these devices stop working at a certain temperature. And you'll have a foundational understanding as to why. Okay. So now, where I jumped ahead, we have 3-5 semiconductors. They come out of column 3, column 5. Very creative, right? 3-5 semiconductors. But it actually is a whole suite of materials like indium, gallium, arsenide, phosphide. You can actually mix those materials together or have binaries like indium phosphide, gallium arsenide, or mix them in alloys. And those are really important to lasers and detectors. And they're much more expensive to manufacture. And that's why they're not so widespread. And silicon really has been developing continuously as well. Sort of as a side joke, when I was in grad school, which is about 20 years ago, gallium arsenide was the material of the future. And maybe gallium arsenide will be always the material of the future, right? So it's really being used in specialty devices. Then there's actually 2-6 semiconductors, like cadmium telluride, that is quite extensively used for far infrared detectors. It's a cruddy material. It's soft and difficult to manufacture and to deal with. But it's still a semiconductor. Okay? So it's kind of interesting that all of this is balanced around column 4. Right? And by the end of the course, you'll hopefully understand why that might be. Okay. Actually, there's a lead sulfide. Is a 4-6 semiconductor, which was one of the first semiconductor diodes being worked at. It sort of falls out of the normal scope. Not all of these sort of Lego pieces work together. There's issues of strain and lattice mismatch and operation at room temperature and their chemical stabilities. And so it looks like a Lego box, but you can't always put all the Legos together arbitrarily. All right, so let's assume we can put atoms together. Let's try to understand how we arrange them with each other to make a device. So you might think of a solid crystal where you place atoms in specific position and specific orientations in terms of their chemical bonding. Another way is maybe to look at plastic crystals where they are at specific positions, but the atoms have sort of the arrangement of the cells have random orientations. There's also something called a liquid crystal where all the elements in this crystal have a specific orientation, but have random position. And then there's the liquid where these elements have random position and random orientation. Okay, so we typically deal with things that are on the top left here, but there is liquid disco displays. We're not going to study them in this course, but the foundation we typically deal with here is in solid crystals. And what you see here now on the bottom, or in this transmission micrograph, is a representation of a silicon substrate covered with silicon dioxide, rust, and then polycrystalline silicon. And to give you an idea of dimensions here, well, each little dot is an atom, right? So that's quite a diagram that you can actually look at the atomic displacements or the atomic dimensions. You can beautifully see how this is very well arranged in a crystal, right? Very regular. And then you see the sort of this messy thing here, the silicon dioxide. It's an oxide and it's amorphous. It's random, completely random. It doesn't have a long range order. I mean, you can see sort of locally, you can see a little bit of order, but if I give you this atom here on the bottom left in silicon, and I give you the orientation of this crystal, you can figure out where every other atom is in this whole crystal. Right? Versus here in the oxide, that would be hard. Up here we have polysilicon, and there the arrangement is slightly different than the crystal, and you also have multiple crystallites that might be arranged sort of randomly. So there's a big, so you sort of see a different arrangement here on the bottom left. So it's not as well ordered as the pure crystal silicon, and it has chunks of polycrystalline. So here, this is a polycrystalline film. It's being used in thin film transistors typically. The oxide is amorphous. You need to wonder why. And this is really beautifully crystalline, and you ask yourself what the definition of that is. Yeah?
How do they take in image?
I believe this is a TEM, transmission electron micrograph. The question was how the image was taken. So we'll go through some quantitative definitions. So it's really a correlation spectrum and diffraction patterns. That is really what you can get out of a silicon crystal. If you look at any traditional device that you buy today, you have all of these components in there. You have silicon, you have this SiO2 and other oxides now, and you have poly in there. And we'll focus on the crystals here first, and hopefully can transfer that knowledge of what we learn about the crystals into other materials as well. All right? So keep it simple, stupid, right? Start from the simple stuff. All right. So let's look at crystals. So I'm showing you here a sort of a 2D array of dots, and they don't have to be atoms. It could be anything, right? It could be a geometry of individual elements that are arranged in two dimensions, and the concepts that we learn here are the same for 3D elements. Now, in a semiconductor or any material, solid material, you have roughly in one mole of that material, you have 10 to the 23 particles. That's a large number. So large that certainly I can't wrap my head around how large that really is. So you can't solve equations of that many particles. Right? You can't even conceptualize them, really. And you can dream of a future computer, but you can't even dream of a future computer that's big enough to solve that. Right? So you need to introduce some concepts that help you understand this better. So the first thing that is being done in these semiconductor materials is to understand just this infinite array. And if you really know the position of one element here and the orientation of this crystal or this pattern, you know where everybody else is. So you may not have to solve it in a system of equation of 10 to the 23 or larger, but maybe you can solve it with something simpler. So what you do is you conceptualize it as a simple repeated cell, a small cell. And given that small cell, you can recreate the whole crystal, right? You can see out of this little yellow cell, I can basically map out every other atom in this device or in this structure. But this is not unique, right? I can also dream of other cells, right? So here in this cell, we basically have a quarter of this dot in each cell on the corner. I can also dream of a cell that is basically filling the whole space, but is taking the full cell. I can also slant this thing here, and I still get a full description of the crystal by repeating it, right? So the point is, cells are not unique. You can come up with many cells that will describe ultimately this crystal. So they can be also primitive or non-primitive. For example, the blue cell here will also do, right? I can take that and repeat it, with a different translation vector, right? Instead of a single vector here, a single unit to the left and one unit up, I would have to go two units to the right and two units up, right? But in principle, I can duplicate, again, this whole pattern. So, here's a foundational description, right? A primitive cell is a cell that contains the minimal possible number of atoms in this that you can use and repeat, okay? That number may not have to be one. Could be two or more. But there's also non-primitive cells that are sort of made up of primitive cells, in a sense, okay? Okay. The important thing is, though, that the property of one cell defines the property of the whole solid. Okay? So now the question is, can you come up with a methodology that will always give me, regardless of the crystal, will give me one common, unique cell, and everybody knows what that cell is. Okay? So this is called, it's the Wigner-Seitz primitive cell. And you can derive it from mathematics, or you can sort of show it in a sort of in a pictorial way. And we'll do both. So you choose a reference atom, say this one, and you draw connections to all the neighbors. Okay? So you basically draw straight lines to each of the neighbors, like that, the immediate neighbors, first and second nearest neighbor. And then you, in 2D, you draw lines or planes in 3D normal to these at the midpoint of each of these lines. Okay, so you subdivide this like here in two, right? So you see the line running from the center to the west. Here is subdivided in half, and then you do that for all these others as well. And then you get the so-called smallest volume cell. So this is sort of a graphical method to obtain the smallest volume primitive cell. And that's what people refer to the Wigner-Seitz cell. And it's a method, right? Or it's a trick used many times. So there's other ways to construct it, and you can also do it mathematically. But the point is, this is a reasonable graphical instruction of this. And then you can take a cell and put it into a lattice. So each of these dots here could be a single atom, or it could be a cell that you just saw. Okay? So there's many different Bravais lattices that you can describe, and what you do is, in 2D, you need basically two vectors, and given these two vectors, A and B, in this lattice here, so this is a simple square lattice, you can define and reach any point on the lattice by just taking integer numbers on these vectors. Right? So, very simple. The point is that each of these cells that you have here, they must be the same as you reach them through this description. Okay? So this here, as such, is not a Bravais lattice, even though it just basically has two of these meshes sort of in each other. This is not a Bravais lattice, because if you go from this point to this point here, you don't reach the same configuration. But you can turn this guy here into a Bravais lattice with a basis that looks like this. Does that make sense? So if you give a methodology that this is arranged here in a Bravais lattice and the basis on each point might be more complicated, then you can recreate the whole thing like this, again, with a Bravais lattice and a basis. Okay? One is sort of the periodically arrangement of the pattern, and the other is the tile that you arrange periodically. Okay? Or the content that you arrange periodically. All right. So in 1D, it's very simple. There's exactly one primitive cell, But there's other elements that are not truly 1D, but they kind of have a 1D properties, like polymers or DNA and 1D heterostructures are lasers and RTDs. These things can often be solved analytically, and they have many nice analogs in 2 and 3D systems. So here is something that looks kind of like a 1D structure, right? And you can repeat it like this, or this chemical compound here. So now let's look at in 2Ds. So there's really 5 types. There's the simple square, where each axis is slightly the same, and the vector in between is 90 degrees. Then there is one that's rectangular, where the axes are still orthogonal to each other, but they have different lengths. Then there is the so-called hexagonal, where the basis vectors are spread out by 120 degrees, but the axes are the same. And then there is an oblique, where the vectors are of different lengths, and they are not in 90 degrees inner angle. All right? And then there is a centered rectangular or rhombic or triangular that has 2 atoms per cell, and this has different A's but has 90 degrees. All right, so here's graphene. It has been, when was this, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, it got a Nobel Prize pretty rapidly because it has interesting properties that may be very important. And it's patterned like this, looks like a chicken wire. It's made up of 2 atoms, in a sense. They are identical atoms, but they see different environments. Okay? So this one is connected to the southwest and northwest and to the east. Right, and this B is connected to the west and then northeast and southeast. All right, so they see different chemical environments. So this, as such, is not a Bravais lattice. But if you take this cell, you can see that if you can translate it with very simple vectors into a Bravais lattice. Okay. And repeat it. So that's part of your homework assignment that is being handed out today. Here's a couple of items. Here's an Escher tiling. It's not a Bravais lattice, but this could be converted into a Bravais lattice, so it's kind of artsy. But there's other tiles, like a Penrose tiles or ancient tiles like that. They have 2 different unit cells, like these, but they're arranged in random order. And once you have a random order in there, you can't really make a Bravais lattice out of it. Right? A Bravais lattice ultimately means you can get it out of periodic arrangements. Okay? All right. So, out of these Bravais lattices, in 2D that you've seen, you can sort of understand that there might be in 3D, there might be a couple of more. Okay? And so the simple one is simple cubic. Then there's something called tetragonal, where it's A, and C, and A is not equal to C. So 2 of the vectors have the same length, but they have a different height, but still 90 degrees between them. Orthorhombic means A, B, and C are different, but they still have the same 90 degrees in between. Rhombohedral has A, and A, but one of the angles is not 90 degrees. Triclinic basically has alpha and beta and gamma all not different from 90 degrees. And out here, monoclinic has, again, 2 of the angles are 90 degrees. The other one is not. And then there's something that's really odd in there that's hexagonal, which is similar with a 120-degree angle definition. And A, there's two A's and one C, one growth direction here that's different. So these are called primitive cells. Now you have, out of those you can construct others. For example, you can think of this cubic one, you can place an atom right in the middle between all these faces, right in the middle of the volume, that's called body-centered. So you can construct out of cubic, out of tetragonal, and orthorhombic, you can construct body-centered ones. Then there's face-centered ones, where you take cubic and orthorhombic and place an atom on the centers, on the center of each face of this cube or of this geometry. And there is an element that Bravais lattice elements that are called single face centered. They are out of these. So now you ask yourself, why are the others not filled? Okay, so by geometrical arguments, you can actually show that if you pick any one of these, you can represent them out of the other Lego blocks, so to speak. So these 14 are the ones that are considered the foundational ones, the Bravais lattice ones in 3D. And they're out here, for example, you might think, well, how about a tetragonal face-centered one? So we'll look at one like this. So here, this is tetragonal face-centered. We'll repeat it in a larger cell. So basically, you now have four of those guys. And if you just take away these guys, you see this is, again, a body-centered one that was rotated around. Okay? So this is tetragonal body-centered. So tetragonal face-centered can be just described as tetragonal body-centered in a simpler way, with less atoms in it. Okay? So that's the key element. You can find a more foundational cell in the white spaces, so to speak. So tetragonal face center is really like tetragonal body centered. And in 1942, there's a person called Frankenheim, sounds pretty German to me. He counted 15 unit cells. And Bravais pointed out that two cells were duplicated, and that's unfortunately to Frankenheim, because nobody knows anymore who he was, but Bravais is in every textbook. Okay, so just a small mistake. So this guy is really an example that has historical relevance in a sense. So this cubic is of course conceptually very simple, right? But it's experimentally very unusual. It barely shows up. If you look at all natural crystalline materials, 70 to 75% show up as body-centered, face-centered, or hexagonal. Okay, so those are not so simple to describe, but that's what we get from nature. And maybe we can figure out why in part that is. And that has to do maybe with some packing density. So, let's look at a simple cubic lattice. So here we go. You can sort of see that that there is really 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times an eighth of a single atom in there, right? Right. You can take a single atom at the edge here. You put it into the planes. You can see you're basically left with an eighth, right? So this cell is made up of one atom, effectively in per unit cell. So the points per unit cell are an eighth of a corner times eight corners, so that's 1 point per cell. Okay? And again, I could shift this cell around and make that calculation more simple or more complicated. But this simple cubic unit cell basically has one point per cell. And the number density is how many atoms do you put in there? And it's really one per volume, right? And the volume is a cubed, okay? So that'll give you number of points per centimeter cubed. And obviously that should not depend on the cell definition, right? If you take a chunk of material and you figure out what the density is and you want to describe it, that density doesn't change with a mathematical model that you describe the periodic structure with, right? That better be the physical constant. So the individual model that describes the repeated cell might change, right? But the physically measured quantity of a number density, in a sense, cannot change. That should be invariant of the model that you use to describe it. Does that make sense? I see some frowning and I see some nodding. All right? So, if I now look at the packing density, which would be the filled volume over the total volume, and I imagine that I have a cubic cell like this, it's pretty clear that we can pack cells like this in here that are defined by dots that are defined by, say, a radius R. And we can, the radius here in this cubic cell can be half of A, right? So that's the maximum radius. The volume that we have in here is in the sphere is 4/3 of pi R cubed, right? Very simple geometric volume. And we have we decided that we really have one of these guys in the whole cell, or we can say 1/8 times 8 corners, so again 1, right? And we basically pack one sphere into the whole volume, right? Does that make sense? Either eight corners 8 times, or we shift the cell and then we pack in one, right? So you, that makes it out to be pi over 6, that's about 52%, right? That means half of the volume is empty, okay? Doesn't seem like a very efficient way of packing balls together, right? All right. The other item that I want to highlight here now is that the chemistry really happens on surfaces, okay? When you grow materials or you look at interactions with the environment, typically it happens on the surface. So it's actually important to also look at the aerial densities that help us understand how many dangling bonds we might have on the surface. Because if there's a dangling bond that might be waiting to couple to some other material or atom that comes in, that might be, if you have lots of dangling bonds on there, it might be very interesting for other atoms to connect to. But if you have no dangling bonds, how would they attach, right? They would have to break some bonds first in order to insert themselves, okay? So understanding surfaces is very critical. So we'll look at a surface like that up here, and we'll start looking at the aerial density of this simple cubic cell. And basically you have four corners and you contain a quarter per atom. So it's really one over the square. Okay? So effectively on there you see one atom per unit cell at the surface. If it's face diagonal, say we clipped, I mean, we imagine this, right? You have this huge crystal, right? And it's cubic, and you can dice it along this plane, and you basically get one atom per unit area, crystal, periodic length. Or you can think about just cutting it this way at a diagonal. Right? And if you don't think much about it, you might say, well, that should be the same thing. But if you actually look at it cut like this, you get not as many atoms in this plane. Okay? So if somebody gave you this perfect simple cubic lattice and you sliced it in two different crystal direction and sheared it and cleaved it, one surface would be more reactive than the other. Okay? So sometimes we talk about 100 crystals and 111 crystals. That's where this is aiming towards, okay? That that crystals are not behaving the same in all directions. And some of the quantitative aspects of crystals are very different. All right, so now let's look at BCC and FCC lattices. Here's a body-centered cubic. So this has, just like the cube, right, it had one inside. An eight of 1/8 on the corners, and now we add one on the inside. Okay, so this has two points per cell. The face-centered one is like the cubic one, so it has eighths on the corner, but only an eighth. And then it has six halves on the surfaces. Right, everybody sees that? So there's 4 points per unit cell in this one. Okay. Hexagonal closed packed looks like this. And we'll go through the points per cell again. So we have two equivalent on these surfaces here, so halves, twice. And then to understand the other ones, you can sort of draw a neighboring cell, and you find that you basically have here at the corners, you have 12 of these corners, and you contain 1/2 and 1/3 coming out to a 2. So that gives you 3 points per cell. All right. So why would we do these simple cells? Do we have a lot of elements that show up in these simple cells? Not really. So there's a couple that you might have seen or might be familiar with. Sodium chloride is cooking salt, right? So you might have seen that little small cooking salt is actually crystalline, and it shows up in this crystal structure. So in a Bravi lattice, every point has the same environment as every other point, same number of neighbors, next neighbors, etc. But as I mentioned before, it could be contained in different unit cells. So again, as you relate A and B into discrete descriptions of pointing to any arbitrary point in the crystal through some integer indices, you have to make sure that each of these allowed points sees exactly the same environment. Okay? Not similar. Exactly. All right, so I had shown this one before, right? So you can transform this guy into this with the basis of this. Right, make sense? Good. So now you can take the rock salt, sodium chloride. It looks like this. So it's basically sodium chloride, right? Looks like a simple cubic cell. But is that a Bravi lattice? Why not? Because the sodium sees chlorides, and the chloride sees sodium. So just by a path of finding each spot on the crystal, you have not defined what the environment of each atom is. Okay? But you can take a cell like this, which is again chloride and sodium, and out of that you can construct in this basis of two atoms a cell that looks like this. Okay? So that looks like cubic face-centered. Does that make sense? And suddenly with cubic face-centered, with this basis, you can make rock salt or sodium chloride. Is that a little bit? Okay, I see much more nodding than the simple cells. Good. All right, so here now zinc blender, which is the gallium arsenide crystal. So here's a chunk of gallium arsenide. So each gallium is connected to arsenic, okay? And basically it's the word now. So the way I remember this one long when I was still at a lecture, imagine you have one atom here at your belly button. You have one on each foot, and then you have the other one here. Okay? So that's, keep that, that stuck in my mind for a long time. So that is how an arsenic is really, it stands on two legs, and it puts its arms up in the other way. Okay? It can make up that cell. So, but really, to make it a Bravais cell, you have to do a little bit more sophisticated thing. So here's your arsenic, gallium and your arsenic, and you kind of see that there's equivalent ones on the corners here that see the same environment, but this guy here on the corner sees a slightly different environment, right? It doesn't have a bond here. Okay? Does that make sense? So it's clear that you have to come up with a little bit of a different description for zinc blender than this as a unit cell. Well, this you could use as a unit cell and repeat it, but that's not the primitive cell. So, but how many atoms are in here? You see that you have 8 on the corners, and then you have 6 on the faces, and you have 4 on the inside. Does that make sense? You can count it, right? 4 big ones on the inside, 6 on the faces, and 8 on the corners. So that's 8. So, but now we can take this simple cell and repeat it in a tetragonal structure like this. And I want to show you that from an images that are taken from Crystal Viewer, so that you can basically repeat on the web. So now I'm taking the bonds away, so it looks less descriptive, right? So here the bonds sort of make sense. Here's the tetragon is still here, right? 2 legs, 2 arms. So I'm taking the bonds away. I'm taking one of the species away. And I'm coloring the species slightly different. And you can sort of see a pattern already here. I'm connecting the pattern here. Okay? So now I connected out of these atoms, I basically connected what? A face-centered cubic. Okay? So I leave that face-centered cubic here and reinsert it in here. Okay? Now I can color the pink ones and basically have another face-centered cubic. And I have basically 2 face-centered cubics that are interleaved with each other. Okay? So that is what we describe typically gallium arsenide with. It's a zinc blender. It's a FCC cell with 4 atoms per unit cell, the brown species. And FCC, 4 atoms per unit cell, the purple species. And with that, you make up zinc blender, which is 2 FCC bases separated by 1/4, 1/4, 1/4. Okay? So you start from an FCC and say, I have another atom that is now displaced in FCC by 1/4, 1/4, 1/4 in a Cartesian system, and that is what we call zinc blender. All right, so here, diamonds are forever. Oh, never mind. So diamond is basically the same stuff, except that all these atoms are of the same species. It also has then basically 2 FCC bases separated 1/4, 1/4, 1/4. But you don't have 2 species, just a single one. Alright, so we're almost running out of time. Lecture is almost done. So here is hexagonal for cadmium selenide. So the point is now you have 2 hexagonals that are interweaved with each other. And you can figure out first by looking at the cadmium and its neighbors and figure out how many cells there are. And I think I'm running out of time before I talked on surfaces. So I'll pick up here at the lecture again on Thursday on surfaces. So thank you. I'll see you Thursday.